Diverse, independent, yours. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC.
Land expropriation. More than 2 million dunams of land, more than one-third of the West Bank, has been taken from Palestinians using a variety of different legal tools. Our report goes into excruciating detail about each legal mechanism to explain the ways in which the Israeli government has stolen land from Palestinians to give it to settlements. It is also worth noting that this system of land expropriation has reduced Palestinians to living in 165 non-contiguous territorial islands. This is a result of the mass expropriation of Palestinian land.
That's Umar Shakir, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Umar Shakir on Israel-Palestine, a threshold crossed. 30 years ago, the Oslo Accords between Israelis and Palestinians were signed. There was widespread fanfare and jubilation. There was Clinton standing between Rabin and Arafat, bringing them together at the White House. It was a new dawn. Finally, peace in the Holy Land. The pundits and the polls told us it was a miracle. Where is that miracle today? The chance of a viable, independent Palestinian state has become a pipe dream. Israeli oppression of Palestinians is not random, but systemic. Land, which was to be part of a Palestinian state, has been seized for Israeli-only settlements. Meanwhile, Washington enables Israeli policies. While there has been some shift in U.S. public opinion, the ruling political class ignores the realities on the ground. Our guest today is Umar Shakir. He's the Israel-Palestine Director of Human Rights Watch. He's the author of that organization's report, A Threshold Crossed. Prior to working for Human Rights Watch, he was a fellow at the Center for Constitutional Rights. He investigated human rights violations in Egypt, including the Rabaa massacre. I talked with Umar Shakir in May at the University of Denver. After our interview, Umar Shakir spoke to students and faculty at the University of Denver. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with a working definition of human rights.
Human rights are what international law defines as the basic freedoms that all people around the world, regardless of who they are, where they come from, should enjoy. They include basic civil and political rights, the right to free expression, free assembly, free association, the right to live free from the unjustified interference of government force. They obviously also include very critical socioeconomic rights, right to health. There's an increasing body of work on right to electricity. So this is what has developed over many decades in the lexicon of international law as the sort of baseline for what we should hold rights bearers, starting with governments, but not exclusive. This also applies to, non-state groups, increasingly being applied to companies, to international organizations. It's the basic requirements that the law sets out whenever it comes to the well-being, freedoms of individuals.
In the media, human rights is like a political football. There are uses and abuses of it. Talk about that.
Absolutely. I think the problem with how Human Rights Watch is human rights in general is discussed globally is that it's often weaponized when one side of an argument wants to put down the other side. Well, your human rights record here, your human rights record there. And I think Human Rights Watch's starting point is to say, look, we don't take political positions, even on war and occupation. We actually don't take positions one way or another. We document abuses committed by all actors in the context not only of conflict, but even in normal, ordinary extraordinary situations. So I think the key, and this is a point Human Rights Watch has made recently vis-a-vis Ukraine, is to say it's fantastic that folks are mobilizing using the tools of international law and human rights as a way to push for accountability and addressing the situation on the ground. But the key to these instruments actually having any meaning and weight is that they're applied universally in all different contexts, regardless of the political considerations.
December marks the 75th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That's a significant foundational document.
Absolutely. It's certainly one of the key pillars in the architecture of international law that led us to where we are today, where you have an entire apparatus of conventions, of customary international law that are protective of human rights, civil and political rights, prohibition against torture. You go down the list of different laws, and I think the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was a critical piece of moving the world to a place in which human rights is at least enshrined in law. Now, in practice, they're not being protected in many, if not all, parts of the world. And so the challenge for those of us in civil society is to take those words and to translate them into action.
There's lots of lofty rhetoric coming from Washington about human rights. Yet the U.S. has a very mixed record, particularly with its refusal to join the International Criminal Court, which ironically, it was one of the original propagators of establishing the ICC. Now, NPR said the U.S. has a complicated relationship, that's a direct quote, with the ICC. What's that about? Why isn't the United States the bastion of human rights, a member of the ICC?
I think when we talk about double standards in international law and human rights, I think the United States is at the top of the list of those that are guilty. And I think their ICC approach is very indicative, right? When it comes to certain situations, whether it's Libya, whether it's Sudan, whether now it's with Ukraine and Russia, where the particular issue in front of the court is one that fits with the U.S. geostrategic, geopolitical agenda for the region, they jump to defend these principles. But in other situations, in Israel-Palestine is by no means unique in this regard. You can look at Egypt, you can look at Saudi Arabia, you can look at numerous other examples around the world where the human rights principle-based call do not line up with U.S. interests. Too often the United States is on the wrong side of this. So in the case of the ICC, yes, we've seen them make references to particular indictments, most recently of Vladimir Putin in Ukraine. There are anecdotes before that of Sudan and Libya where the United States has directly, if not directly, indirectly, been on the side of supporting the ICC and defending it. But just a few years ago, the Trump administration issued sanctions against the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, and that was in part over the decision to open a formal probe into serious crimes committed in Palestine. That's not the only example, but it goes to show you, again, the ICC has become the foremost or one of the foremost examples that amplify the double standard in the United States government's approach to human rights and international law and accountability.
Double standards. Critics say adversarial states like Iran, Syria, Russia, China, Cuba, North Korea, Venezuela, and others are held by the U.S. to one set of standards, while U.S. allies, such as Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, India, Turkey, and Israel, are given basically a free pass. How does Washington get away with that?
I think that's a great question, but undeniably that's largely accurate. I mean, the reality here is that the United States has strong rhetoric. When you look at human rights abuses in certain contexts, you mentioned Iran, Venezuela, I think largely, if you take the Ukraine, if you took the very same kinds of statements, pronouncements, actions in some of those contexts and applied them in others, that's exactly what human rights organizations have been calling for. But the United States has not been consistent. And that, I think, not only undermines U.S. credibility, but I think more importantly, undermines those very international principles. Let me give you an anecdote. It's undeniable that the United States now and other countries are pushing, for example, for support from the global south when it comes to Ukraine. Similarly, when it comes to the indictment of Vladimir Putin and others, but many of these states are asking the question of, okay, where were you when it comes to these abuses taking place in Palestine? And the lack of a good answer leads these states in many cases. Again, the answer should be yes, do it in Ukraine, also do it in Palestine. But for some states, they're turning to no here. If it's not here, it's not there. And so I think it's not only undermining the U.S. credibility, which I think has been over many years undermined by their support for abusive regimes across the world, and they're overlooking, and in some cases even greenlighting abuses, but it actually undermines those very principles, which also in turn means undermining protections of human rights everywhere.
During the so-called war on terror, the U.S. has committed unambiguous war crimes, specifically the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, Abu Ghraib, and the infamous collateral murder shooting of Iraqi citizens, the bombing of Afghan wedding parties and Afghan civilians. I don't know if you saw this excellent film about Mohamedou Ould-Slahi called The Mauritanian, about how he was unlawfully and cruelly imprisoned for years and years. I mean, you have that black stain of Guantanamo. There is no accountability. The U.S. has impunity when it comes to international law.
I represented men detained in Guantanamo Bay, so I spent 2 years shuttling back and forth to the prison, so I know firsthand the horrors of unjust, arbitrary detention without trial or charge, of torture, what it's like for those men. I've met them, I've spoken with them, I've seen their conditions. I also have documented U.S. drone strikes. My first major human rights report that I worked on as an advocate over a decade ago was about U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan, so I'm intimately aware not only of these really serious abuses of international law and human rights, but the fact that there's been no accountability. And one of the points that we make everywhere around the world is when there's impunity for serious abuses, you open the door to their recurrence. It's no coincidence that the lack of accountability for torture under the Bush administration created a situation where when a Trump comes to power, he can openly talk about the possibility of torture. We still today in 2023 have men held in Guantanamo Bay. That is an absolute moral outrage. And I think it's critical for all advocates of human rights to be consistent in their application, to call it out in the United States, just as you would call it out in Ukraine. And too often, there is a selective invocation of principles which undermines all of our work.
The Arab Middle East is ruled by kings, sultans, emirs, and generals. What's the overall human rights situation in the region?
It's quite poor. And I take this from somebody who, I've been kicked out of three, not just Israel, putting Israel-Palestine aside, three other governments have blocked my entry over my human rights work: Syria, Egypt, and Bahrain. I've been in Egypt. I've been in morgues documenting the killings of protesters by the Egyptian regime. I documented the Rabaa massacre back in 2013. I lived in Syria before even the Arab uprising and was looking into contemporary issues. So undeniably, the situation of human rights abuse across the region is alarming. We've had a regression in many countries, even from the situation was looking like in 2010, right before the advent of the Arab Spring. And that's built on impunity. There are abusive actors in the region that have committed serious abuses, that are increasingly empowered, that are empowering one another, that are empowering regressive forces in these countries. And there's undeniably some degree of popular support, there has been, for some of this repression. Even where there is criticism, the constellation of power is such that they're not able to challenge and push back always. Or when they do, in places like Sudan and elsewhere, they're subjected to really serious high degrees of violence by the state and by state officials. So I think undeniably across the region, it's a really dark, challenging time for human rights.
Well, let's focus on Egypt, generally regarded as the most important Arab state. It's been described by Amnesty as an open-air prison, quote unquote. There was a coup d'etat which overthrew a democratically elected government of Mohamed Morsi in 2013. And you mentioned the Rabaa massacre on August 14th, 2013. You investigated it. What happened there exactly, and what kind of numbers are we talking about?
I mean, we had one of the largest single-day killings of protesters in modern world history, something on the scale of Tiananmen. We were there on that day. We were there in the days and weeks after, interviewing victims and families. We were in the morgues. We were counting the bodies. We ourselves, in the span of 12 hours, we counted over 800 Egyptians that were gunned down on that day. We believe the actual number is likely well over 1,000, given ones that we weren't able to actually count. This was not some abstract situation where people went crazy. This was as our reports called all according to plan. These killings were ordered at the highest level of the Egyptian government, signed off by folks including Abdel Fattah Sisi, that ordered the killings of protesters. They anticipated even more than the number that were killed. They opened fire on people that were, largely nonviolent. Even the government said the number of guns they found in Rab'a with a protest that had tens of thousands of people was 15 on a press conference that night. So we're talking about really a mass, gunning down of protesters. It is a dark stain, not only on Egypt, but on the entire region. And the fact that some of those very people who carried out that massacre not only have not been held to account, not only do they continue to hold in detention some of the people who survived that massacre, but those people are now entrenched in leadership in Egypt and continuing to double down on political repression, tens of thousands of political prisoners. It is extremely alarming where Egypt is today.
And that massacre took place during the Obama administration. What was Barack Obama's position on what happened?
There was some discussion within the U.S. government about, first of all, labeling what happened as a coup. This has been well documented in the reporting of David Kirkpatrick and others. There was some discussion about some sort of, sanctioning of the Egyptian government. And in fact, years later, there were some minor pockets of funding that were conditioned or withdrawn or held back. But the overarching message, and this has been followed by Trump and even Biden, right, has been to normalize this government, to not hold individuals accountable, to not use U.S. leverage to put sufficient weight. The U.S. considers Egypt to be an important ally, including on Israel-Palestine, and it's willing to overlook and, sanction the Egyptian government's repression.
So what are the possibilities of Biden calling up General Sisi and getting those political prisoners, which I think number in the thousands?
Tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands released.
Biden talked about human rights being the center of their policy, but that's not been the reality. In the Middle East has been the most stark. I mean, look across the way at Saudi Arabia and what happened with Jamal Khashoggi, what the administration said would happen in terms of accountability. We see it now with Shireen Abu Akla, another U.S. citizen journalist gunned down in Palestine. We see it with Egypt. We don't see the United States actually putting their principles into actions. We don't actually see human rights being at the center of its policy. So I would love to say that the U.S. would put leverage on Egypt. It's possible it's doing so in certain cases where there is a U.S. national, we've seen that pattern, but that's a drop in the bucket compared to the overarching repression. And we're not seeing the U.S., I think, do enough.
Historically, it's been difficult to talk about Israel critically in the United States. Do you see that, any shift in that?
I think that the conversation is absolutely shifting. There are many data points to it, including survey data that's been conducted by many prominent polling organizations showing whether it's young people, whether it's Democrats, whether it's Jewish Americans, shifts in public attitudes, increasing recognition of the reality of apartheid. We also see that in the growing recognition of Israeli apartheid. We see now not only a consensus in the human rights movement that spans Israeli, Palestinian, global human rights organizations, Harvard Law School, International Human Rights Clinic, former UN, current UN experts who have reached that assessment. We see prominent figure, Lawrence Tribe, the professor at Harvard. We see increasing voices that are recognizing the reality for what it is. And now governments. We have the entire South Africa, Namibia. We have countries like Indonesia, Malaysia, the Human Rights Council last year. The entire African bloc, Arab bloc, and Organization of Islamic Conference use the word apartheid. So there is a growing recognition, including in the United States. But the challenge is now it's not yet penetrated the political level. You have some people in Congress, but not nearly enough, including within the Democratic Party. So there's much more work to be done. And then the next challenge is to translate that shift into changes on the ground.
Well, criticism of Israel is sometimes equated with anti-Semitism. And anti-Semitism exists. It's increasing, in fact, unfortunately. So how do you separate those two and de-weaponize the labeling of criticism of Israel as anti-Semitism?
So I think the first thing to say is that, you know, anti-Semitism is a human rights issue. Human Rights Watch has been involved and is involved in documenting and talking about what governments can do to deal with this issue. But the cynical attempt by supporters of the Israeli government to facilely equate criticism of Israel or advocacy with Palestinian rights with anti-Semitism actually undermines that fight against anti-Semitism. Last month, Human Rights Watch joined a number of other Israeli, Palestinian, American Jewish organizations, Amnesty International, in calling for the UN to ensure that its important work to combat anti-Semitism does not result in the stifling of legitimate, you know, free expression. In particular, we called on the UN not to adopt the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, a particularly controversial definition that has been misused to muzzle advocacy for Palestinian rights and criticism of Israel. So that definition shouldn't be used. Anti-Semitism needs to be fought critically, but it needs to be done in a way that doesn't undermine the right to free expression. IHRA is not the way to do it. There needs to be other ways to go.
There have been reports of human rights abuses carried out by the Palestinian Authority in the areas under its control. But what's happening there with the authority and human rights abuses?
Undeniably, Palestinian Authority and Hamas authorities in Gaza have become increasingly thuggish. They are systematically arbitrarily arresting critics, opponents, dissidents, torturing many of those in custody. Human Rights Watch has been documenting this for decades. You know, we've done large reports showing that this is systematic practice, calling for same sorts of remedies we call for with regards to abuses elsewhere in the world, including with the Israeli government, to cut funding to abusive security forces, for there to be accountability, including at the International Criminal Court, for states to call out this reality for what it is and to ensure that they're not complicit in it. So it's a huge part of the picture of the oppression of Palestinians. And let me add that many of those that are locked up by the Palestinian authorities are the same people that are being locked up by the Israeli government. And so in essence, the Palestinian Authority in some ways has become, in some ways complicit with apartheid and the underlying reality, especially when it comes to the security coordination that it does, that sometimes can result in this level of repression, it seems. So I think it's important to understand that when we're talking about human rights in Israel-Palestine, we're not just talking about abuses by the Israeli government. We're also talking about that by Hamas, by the PA, some of which is done in conjunction with the Israeli government and to serve the same underlying realities. And Palestinians ultimately are stuck between multiple authorities that are intolerant of criticism and that are attacking them for their work.
Finally, what can individuals do?
I think individuals, the first thing is, you know, you've got to read up on what's happening. Make sure you're well equipped with the facts. Read the reporting of Palestinian groups, Israeli groups, human rights groups. Share, promote that work. I would say, you know, and I encourage people to talk to their elected representatives, but that's not enough. I think all of us need to look at our own institutions. Go to your church, go to your synagogue, go to your mosque, go to your union, and go to your university. Make sure that you are applying these same principles to your endowments, to your activities, to your study patterns. The U.S. is deeply involved in apartheid. There needs to be a much larger way of due diligence to ensure non-complicity in these crimes.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Uma Shaker on Israel-Palestine, A Threshold Crossed. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. After our interview, Uma Shaker spoke to students and faculty at the University of Denver.
Let me start by saying, I think probably if you're studying here affiliated with the university, you're well aware of the work of Human Rights Watch. But when it comes to Israel-Palestine, we've been working on documenting human rights abuses by Israeli authorities, Palestinian authorities, armed groups, companies for well over 30 years. The impetus for this report probably began about 6 or 7 years ago. At the time, the occupation was getting ready to turn 50. We're now marking 56 years of the occupation this year. And we were reflecting on the body of Human Rights Watch's work.
Over the years, we've documented virtually every abuse of international humanitarian human rights law you can imagine. Whether it's the mass expropriation of Palestinian land, whether it's the restrictions on freedom of movement. But when we reflected on our work, there was an increasing sense that while we had documented critical abuses in certain areas, we were failing to describe the underlying reality on the ground. Now, if I were to explain to a 9-year-old what's happening in Israel-Palestine in 30 seconds, I would say the following: that one government primarily rules over the area between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, the Israeli government. There are two groups of roughly equal size that live in that area, Jewish Israelis and Palestinians. And that government's policy has been methodically to privilege Jewish Israelis and to oppress Palestinians at different degrees of intensity. Now, that simple 3-sentence summary of what's happening in Israel-Palestine, of course, there are many nuances, there are many complexities, it flies in the face, fundamentally, of how Israel-Palestine are discussed in many forums, including, I expect, at this university. Given that disconnect, we asked a different research question when we embarked on this particular report. The research question, again, many of you are in an academic university, so let me ask it as a research question. How does Israel treat Palestinians? So we embarked on a 2-year research project to better understand the answer to that question. So what did we do? We did case studies. So we compared the treatment of Jewish Israelis and Palestinians who largely live in segregated communities, by the way, in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem, in Israel, and in Gaza. So we did these detailed case studies. But then to supplement that research, we actually analyzed 30 years of Human Rights Watch's research on human rights abuses in Israel-Palestine. So we aggregated statistics, we analyzed trends, and we looked beyond our own method research. We actually looked at the research of Palestinian, Israeli, other international organizations. So we established this massive collection of data and information, plus the case studies. So then I wrote a report. I wrote a 200-plus page report documenting how Israel treats Palestinians. And by the way, I should note, we didn't just look at those sources. We also looked at the Israeli government justifications for this policy. We looked at policy planning documents. We looked at statements of Israeli officials. We sought to meet the Israeli government to discuss their perspective. They declined that invitation. And then, after we had done that, step 2 was to apply the law. So I know I'm not speaking at a law school, but I want to say a bit about the law because Human Rights Watch, our mandate is international human rights and humanitarian law primarily. So any starting point for research for us has to be the law. So our legal department conducted research on what are the standards under the law for cases of severe discriminatory oppression. Now there is a prohibition under international law. It has the highest status of international law against severe discrimination and oppression. And there's a term for it. That term is apartheid. So while the term was coined in relation to a particular historical events in southern Africa, international treaties, including the International Covenant on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, define apartheid as a universal legal term. If there's nothing else you take away from my talk, take away from it that the activists from South Africa and Southern Africa more generally, back from the 1970s, fought to make this a recognized legal concept to prevent it from happening again. Apartheid is also a crime against humanity, with a definition set out not only in the 1973 Convention on the Suppression of the Crime of Apartheid, but it's also one of 11 crimes against humanity set out under the Rome Statute that created the International Criminal Court. Many of you might know, even if you haven't studied law, you've watched a legal TV show, you know that crimes usually have 3 elements, right? You have an act, you have a mens rea, an intent or a policy, and you have a context. That's how you define a crime. Apartheid is no different as a crime. Basically, we're talking about severe abuses. Things like mass land expropriation, things like forcible transfer on a mass scale, etc. Now, these acts must take place in the context of systematic oppression by one group of people over another. So to have apartheid, you need severe abuses that take place in the context where there is a regime or system of systematic oppression by one group over the other. Thirdly, you need those acts to take place with the intent by the perpetrator to maintain the regime or system of domination. So let me take a step back. Intent to dominate, systematic oppression, inhumane acts. That's what you need legally to find apartheid. Let me note parenthetically, I don't have time to go into it in my presentation, that there is a second related crime against humanity called persecution. Very similar definition, basically severe abuses of fundamental rights when they are carried out with a discriminatory intent. So I laid out our methodology and I laid out the law. So when Human Rights Watch applied the law to the facts that we documented, we concluded that Israeli authorities are committing the crimes against humanity